From the halls of every school in Michigan, this is School Talks on 760 WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy. Sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Now take your seats. Class is in session. Here's Robert.
This week on the program, we're going to enter the world of mental health, but this time from two different perspectives. One, what's best for students, and two, what's best for teachers and the staff who serve them. We'll be joined this week by private practice psychologist Nikki O'Donnell and emotional intelligence specialist Jess Forshey, Fraser Public School Superintendent Carrie Wozniak, and from CARE of Southeastern Michigan, Susan Stife. All this and more coming up. This is 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now in the program is private practice psychologist Nikki O'Donnell and emotional intelligence specialist Jess Forshey. Welcome to the program, ladies.
Hey, thank you.
So, in our continuing focus on mental health and support for children and students in schools, I came across not too long ago a book called The Anxious Generation, which talks about how electronic social media and all the trimmings that go with that have impacted an entire generation of children. And in the mix of that, I think the book is a New York Times bestseller. Mm-hmm. And it is so well written and really hits the point on what we're all living with in the mix of social media and cell phones. And it's, in my opinion, we're to the point now that we're so far in the forest, we can't see the trees, mm-hmm. because it's almost like we're using social media to battle the effects of social media, mm-hmm. and therein lies the forest analogy. So in terms of the anxiety that this book talks about, I start with you, Nikki. What are some of the common mistakes that parents and educators make when trying to help children with anxiety?
Yeah, so this is a funny one because I think a lot of times the things that we intuitively feel like help calm a child may unintentionally enable anxious behavior. Jess and I are working on this really, really innovative program for parents of elementary school kids called It Runs in the Family Till It Ran Into Me. The first series will focus on childhood anxiety, but a lot of what we're talking about there is the steps that we take as parents or educators or just folks in the community who are around children, taking really a look at ourselves, right? How were we taught to manage anxiety, or were we not? Right? We weren't using that language until more recently. So now we're having to sort of reverse engineer solutions in a really different climate. Mm-hmm. You mentioned social media, and that's absolutely, you're hitting the nail on the head.
And you know, my dad used to say when I was a kid that each generation has its own set of problems.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And without question, this is the problem of this generation. And it's so obvious right in front of us. So with respect to parents and educators, Nikki, how do they differentiate between what would be normal stress for a child versus something more classified as clinical anxiety in them?
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said normal stress because it's totally normal. Anxiety is a piece of the alarm system in the body, so we need that. Sort of like how dangerous it would be to not feel physical pain, it would also be dangerous to not have anxiety in that way. Usually what I'll tell folks and parents when I'm working with them is when anxiety starts to take over areas of life for a child, when you're seeing that it's really the fight or flight system, right? And so if that alarm system is just going off constantly in different areas of life for a child, then we have sort of an escalated problem there. That alarm system, we need to take a look. Mm-hmm. And so that's when maybe talking with someone like us, right? Or getting some resources. The Anxious Generation does a great job of sort of talking about some of that.
Yeah, and you know, with respect to the book, Jess, let me ask you, what are some practical strategies that the book talks about for supporting children who are struggling with anxiety, whether it's at home or in school?
Yes, some practical strategies are always good. I like to talk about the neuroscience behind anxiety. Like Nikki mentioned, your anxiety is simply an alarm system. So if you think of your brain as a control panel for your entire body and nervous system, and an alarm's going off, that alarm needs to be investigated. And if the parent doesn't see the alarm, or their alarm isn't set at the same specification as the kids, the parent's just gonna see their child having a really rough time and maybe throwing a fit and having behavioral issues. So understanding that it takes a kid 15 minutes to process cortisol after having a fight or flight episode, and really removing them from the situation, making them feel safe, and then moving forward from there and getting them to calm down and do some breathing exercises.
And
perfect.
Cortisol is the chemical your brain or your body creates to sort of protect itself. Is that right?
It's a stress hormone.
Stress hormone. Okay. Yeah. So, Nikki, let me ask you, with respect to the negative impact of social media, which mm-hmm. there's plenty of, what steps can parents take to mitigate or reduce that for their children?
Yeah. So I kind of have an interesting response to this, a little out of the box. But I actually think the answer lies less in, I mean, social media exists. I'm a parent of a 7 and a 12-year-old, and it is real. And when I was taking steps early on, directly trying to control and manage the fact that this existed, I was failing miserably. It wasn't until I just accepted this will exist for my children for their mm-hmm. entire lives. So introducing into our family, my own little experiment was, when we look outside of life, right? If we're always tuned in, same thing, it happens to me as well. When I'm too consumed with social media, I don't experience any other parts of life. So as parents, we have this cool opportunity to structure the container that is our family, right? Mm-hmm. In such a way where we're involved in a lot of other things in the world, connecting to community, getting kids involved. This is taking the side door, right? If we try to engage in a power struggle of like, you can or can't have the social media, like we totally lost the battle there. Now sure. we're in a tug of war. So I like to take the side door when we sort of tap into what does a kid at the very base need during childhood, right? That's an easy answer. And so mm-hmm. developing schedules that kind of don't leave a lot of time for it is a really, really easy way to sort of help influence. It also allows us to be more involved in what's happening in social media. Like, we wouldn't just let our kids run around the mall, right, yeah. unsupervised. And it's sort of the same thing with social media.
Yeah. We're currently with Nikki O'Donnell and Jess Forshee talking about anxiety, stress, and mental health challenges for children both at home and in school. So, Nikki, as a follow-up, you mentioned the home aspect of how you can work with children. Mm-hmm. And how does that translate to a classroom environment where maybe a teacher could do some things to create a more supportive or inclusive classroom environment?
Yeah, I love this one because I really think it doesn't have to be complicated. You know, I like to really look at, we've gotten a little bit further away from the mechanism of what being a human in these bodies, right? And for children, it's very simple. We you know, they you can immediately see the impact of a situation on a child because their emotions are just right there. We learn to do all kinds of things with them and mask as we get older, but they don't have that yet. So I like to break it down very simply. So a lot of what I see a lot of my friends who are educators doing is introducing things like physical activity during the day within the classroom, whether it's through learning, making that more experiential. These are things that get the body moving that automatically will metabolize cortisol. So already you're managing it at that base level. Mm-hmm. A lot of kiddos have really stressful home environments. It's a stressful world. And as adults, we're struggling. So of course our kids are struggling. So building that in, also just giving kids the language to talk about these things and normalizing it, I think is stellar.
Yeah. You know, we have so much more to talk about. I want to take a brief commercial break, and when we come back, talk a little bit more about the anxious generation. This is 760 WJR.
This This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy, sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran Real Point, Collins and Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Once again, at the head of the class, Dr. Livernoy.
We're back here on School Talks, joined by Nikki O'Donnell, private practice psychologist, along with Jess Forshee, emotional intelligence specialist. Back when I was a teacher a number of years ago, there was a term we used for parents called helicopter parents. And it was a term for the parent who was always at school and sort of smothering either the school activities or their child or whatnot. And in recent years, I've come across a term called the lawnmower parent, which is a parent that wants to mow every obstacle down in front of their child to make life easier for them. And in the book, The Anxious Generation, Jess, tell us a bit about how the book discusses the effects of overprotective parenting on children's ability to manage this whole stress and anxiety world that we live in.
Mm-hmm. I love that you mentioned the lawnmower parent, because cutting down every obstacle in front of your child really caps their capacity to handle their own stress and really is a disservice to your child, right? You don't want your child to have a limitation because you were scared or anxious. So really dealing with your own anxiety first is the best place to start, and then going from there, because then you can see as a healed person, as an outside observer, what's actually going on with your kid.
You know, there's the popularity of those apps like Life 360 that lets a parent know their child's every move. When I was a kid, you get up on a Saturday morning, you'd be gone for 15 hours, mm-hmm. and you'd come home dirty, and they had no idea where you were. And I know so many parents who have these apps, and they monitor their child's every move to the point where it's creating anxiety in them, which I can only imagine they're transferring to their child. And let me ask you this question. Would you agree that the parent who's overly protective through those apps is sending a message to their child that they don't trust them? Is that a fair assessment?
That could be one message that's conveyed to the child. I also think that these are crazy times that we live in, right? And we want to keep an eye on our child, and lots of things happened when the days were that, you know, come home before the streetlights come on.
Mm-hmm.
But I can understand how a child feeling constantly watched will behave differently. Because I know when nobody's watching, I grab an extra cookie from the tray, right? So what are you going
to
do?
Yeah, it isn't. And, you know, Nikki, to that end, there has to be a balance here between providing support and allowing children to face some of these challenges on their own, mm-hmm. I guess whether you're tracking them or not. How does the book discuss that particular balance?
Yeah, so here's the thing too. Children learn far more through action, behavior, and observation than they do lecture, right? Especially young, because that part of their brain, that frontal lobe, is not going to fully develop until they're 25-ish. So we're working with children who have fully developed emotional centers and nobody to drive that bus. So here we are as parents, unintentionally, and I am totally guilty of this, even as a psychologist, of unintentionally communicating to my kids, you can't handle this, so I have to. And that's dangerous, because that's where children aren't learning their own set of boundaries, right? We see in other countries the way that, like, recess looks, right? They're allowed to take risks. You see kids, like, whittling wood with, like, sharp objects. And, you know, there's this new thing. I love calling it free-range parenting, right? It's like having a container in the community where we're all kind of watching. We live on a street with a cul-de-sac, so we sort of have this built in. But it allows them freedom within reason in a way that feels safe.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I love the free range concept. if you know anything about free range chickens, there is an element of disorder to it, mm-hmm. unlike how they're handled in other places. So, Jess, Through the lens of the book, how can parents and educators encourage that resilience in children at the same time without overwhelming them with what the child might think are parental expectations?
Yeah, I love that question. Really giving them space to fail is huge, right? So if they have the opportunity to try, they have the opportunity to make a decision on their own without any interference, or if they become distressed during that challenging time, you can always step in. But allowing them to make the decision and decide for themselves and see how much they can handle really builds their capacity.
Mm-hmm. So we're currently with Nikki O'Donnell and Jess Forshee talking about anxiety, mental health, and social media in children and the impact it has both at home and in schools. And Nikki, from a sort of a baseline, what kinds of signs should parents and educators look for to determine if a child's anxiety is improving or worsening?
Mm-hmm.
It sort of feels like a barometer, but give us some thought on what they should be looking for.
Sure. You're actually going to see two sides of the coin, which I think is interesting, and I see more of now clinically. On one side of the coin, you might see a child whose behavior at school or in one environment is not concerning at all, and all of a sudden, right, we're getting resistance somehow, right? I don't want to go to school. I have a stomach ache. I have a headache. Children will experience physical manifestations of anxiety because they don't have the language for mm-hmm. it. So I always try to look out for that. Even changes in appetite, right? Changes in enjoyment of activities, we can see it on that side. A lot of times we'll see it come out as defiance, surprisingly, because again, this is when children feel out of control, they want control. And like me as an adult, same. So we look for some of those. On the other side of the coin, some children will build up an unnatural tolerance to stress and anxiety, and they'll actually look totally okay. Mm-hmm. I end up worrying about those kids a lot more. But those ones, it looks more like, or it can present in hyper-perfectionism, really holding tight to a set of like really strong expectations that were not set by any parent or anything. Mm-hmm. But again, it's a way for a child to manage, control, have that sense of, right, like safety for themselves in a situation maybe they don't fully understand or don't have that skill yet, right? So we kind of have to look for both.
And that particular example is one that I would correlate strongly to when that student does something unfortunate. Mm-hmm. They're often the one where people say, we didn't see
100%.
Any signs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like they were on the, you know, they were in the debate club. They were all this stuff that sort of gave the impression of a well-rounded, perfect student in school. And when it's actually this compartmentalization of mental health and anxiety. So one last question as it relates to the book, Jess. In this day and age, when I was a kid, everybody wanted to be a basketball player or a football player. And in this day and age, given social media and the amount of information that comes to them, in what ways can educators and parents help children sort of build a healthier sense of their own worth and sort of what their view of success might look like?
I love that question. So like you mentioned, with cell phones and technology and social media, there's a lot of input. So understanding what their output can be, right? So allowing kids to get bored. I know it causes chaos, but it's probably one of the best things to do because then they start thinking for themselves, like, well, what happens when I do this? Or what happens when this happens, right? They start experimenting and like building things within the home, blanket forts or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's just really cool to watch so that they can really see who they are. Then they know like the tangibility behind the thoughts that they have.
Yes. Nikki O'Donnell and Jess Forshee, you have given our School Talks listeners a really healthy perspective on arguably one of the most important topics facing schools. I want to thank you for joining us on the program. We're certainly going to have you back, and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.
Coming up after the break, we'll be joined by Carrie Wozniak, Superintendent of Fraser Public Schools, talking about the health and wellness of teachers and the staff who support our children. This is 760 WJR.
School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Superintendent of Fraser Public Schools, Carrie Wozniak. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here today.
I appreciate that. In education, there are so many different factors to it. We use this term symbiosis to talk about all the different forces at work that go into educating students, families, poverty, all kinds of test scores. You name it. There is something for everyone in the mix of educating students. And often in education, what's overlooked is teacher burnout. And I understand you and Fraser are leading an effort to really study and help prevent teacher burnout, which by all accounts has become a pretty important and difficult problem for schools to deal with, especially on the shortage front. So tell us a bit about the work that you're doing in Fraser to combat teacher burnout.
Yeah, I think right now it's very prevalent, and I really feel that it's something that we need to address. Just looking at the data, you know, there's going to be a really large talent shortage over the next 5 years. I mean, the data is showing us that we are going to need to fill almost over 100,000 teaching positions. And oftentimes we see many of our teachers leaving the profession after only being in it a couple of years. So I think we need to be really strategic as building leaders and district leaders to address that issue and be proactive in the work that we're providing our staff with. So in our district, we've partnered with Chase Mielke. He wrote a book called a book on teacher burnout. He also wrote another book on what building leaders can do to specifically address teacher burnout. And I think we have to have some real specific and direct conversations around it to support our staff.
So, you know, the term burnout is a pretty broad brush assessment of something. How would Chase Mielke define teacher burnout?
Yeah, he talks about really three things: the emotional exhaustion that comes with teaching, the cynicism that we often experience, and then really a lack of a sense of accomplishment that teachers sometimes feel. And a lot of times that's due to they don't feel that they can make a change or make a difference. Mm-hmm. So really tackling those three areas has become very important to us.
You know, one of the most fascinating parts to public education I have experienced and endured for a long time is the basic premise or understanding that many people believe children come to school ready to learn. And in many, many cases, it's far from that. So if you're a principal in Fraser Schools, what kinds of strategies does Mielke recommend to combat this burnout?
Yeah. There's some very specific things we're trying to implement. And one of them is, you know, gratitude practices. How do we very systematically and very intentionally put in different practices of gratitude within our building, setting boundaries, making sure you're balancing your work and home life, building really supportive relationships within our school community, and then making sure our staff is feeling like they're always learning and getting opportunities for personal growth.
All are in just a wonderful basket of helping preserve the profession. Each of those that you listed have very distinct components to them. And when you package it all together, it makes a lot of sense. So you mentioned building supportive things and so on. So what role does this positive psychology, shall we say, play in your approach to the teacher's well-being? How does that sort of work in the mix of a school setting?
I appreciated the fact that when Chase has been working with us, is he takes psychology principles and he really uses them to help us have very practical applications to what we're doing in the classroom. And that means we want to find meaning in our work. We want to be mindful about our mental health and really be thinking about what we're doing as educators in our profession. And a lot of times I think our teachers feel like they are kind of put in this box where they have to follow this curriculum and you know, making sure that they get to the end of this chapter or whatever the end is that they're expected to do with the curriculum. And we sometimes lose sight of that, the personalness of teaching and learning.
Mm-hmm. We're currently with Carrie Wozniak, Superintendent of Fraser Public Schools, talking about teacher burnout, a topic that is often overlooked in education, just given everything else that's happening with students and the schools that serve them. And in the mix of a teacher who is experiencing burnout, what would you or what would Milky suggest are some things you can do to actually help a specific teacher in need?
All right. I think the administration has to be right on the front lines with that. We have to make sure we're creating policies and addressing some of the things that are coming to them from parents, from the, just from the state and the policies that are coming at them to help reduce some of those unnecessary burdens that are being put on our teachers. I think providing really intentional professional development on resilience and well-being is very important. It's very different than it was even 5 or 10 years ago, I think post-COVID. And we've thought very intentionally about the PD that we've provided our staff with. So when we have a speaker come in like Chase, he's really helping them thinking about their own well-being and strategies that they can use within the classroom and even at home to help them be better educators. And then the last piece, I think, is that peer support. I think having professional learning communities where teachers are working with one another, working smarter, and working collaboratively is so important right now. I think a lot of times teachers feel like they're on an island in that classroom. So the more opportunities you can give our teachers to collaborate and work together and to work smarter is so important.
Mm-hmm. And that seems especially important now, given the advancements in artificial intelligence. For all of us who ever went to school, the teacher was always the authority. Right? They're the ones that had all the answers and so on. And artificial intelligence, it seems to be changing on a daily basis, is just a dramatic game changer for teachers who once sort of held all the keys to the locks of knowledge and that, and it was the student's job to get it from the teacher. Well, now, just the way artificial intelligence can generate ideas and things really incredibly forces the need for teachers to collaborate to be better facilitators of what it is that we call this business of education. So on that note, I've become aware of something in Fraser called the Be Nice Club.
Yes. Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, and I think that really is something that has come out of the work that we've been doing with Chase and the work we've been doing with mental health. It stemmed right from the students who also really talk a lot about the stress that they're feeling. And the Be Nice Club is out of Grand Rapids on the west side of the state. And it's all about using that acronym NICE. It stands for Notice What Is Right or Different About Others. Invite yourself to reach out if you notice someone struggling. Challenge, you know, stigmas about mental health. And empower yourself and others with knowledge and resources. So it's got a little acronym. And this Be Nice group has just been set up at our middle school and our high school the past 2 years. And our staff that work with them are just about doing little things within the building to make people feel better about themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's just those simple acts of kindness that we've really seen a difference. And the other nice part about it is it's about supporting mental health. And anyone can be a part of the Be Nice Club. It doesn't require you to be, you know, an athlete or some sort of academic standing mm-hmm. of that sort. It really is just about kids that want to work together to do something good for the school community. And it's been really positive for the teachers and the staff that have been involved. Our social workers, our counselors have really had a chance to lead this work. And again, it really fits in nicely with what we're trying to do to support mental health and well-being within the district.
You know, the notion of providing support to teachers so often overlooked, but the kind of work you're doing in Fraser, I think really has the opportunity to prevent teacher burnout. And what I really appreciate about your message today is it's not some big elaborate scheme, right? It's more about the day-to-day culture of the school, the Be Nice Club, and so on. And I think you're doing great work in Fraser. So, Carrie Wozniak, Superintendent of Fraser Public Schools, I appreciate you joining us on the program today.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up after the break, we'll be joined by Susan Steiff from Care of Southeastern Michigan. We'll be back right after this.
School Talks on WJR is sponsored by Wakely Associates, Point Moran Real Point, Collins & Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Now let's get back to class. Once again, your host, former Superintendent Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is the Chief Executive Officer of CARE of Southeastern Michigan, which is an organization really anchored in supporting people's mental health in a number of things, Susan Stipe. And I want to take a moment and welcome you, Susan, to School Talks.
Oh, thank you. I'm really excited to be on with you.
I appreciate your time. So most important, what is the mission and primary focus of CARE in Macomb County?
Yes, I really like talking about this because when we developed our mission statement, it was very important to us and very organic about how we came to it. So our mission is to strengthen resiliency in people and their communities. And we do this through prevention, education, and services that improve the quality of life. And it was very important to us to incorporate the concept of resiliency in our mission statement, because we know that we can't prevent every problem, but we do know that strong resiliency will allow people to be capable of handling anything that comes their way. So this is our primary focus in Macomb County, is we work with individual peoples, and we do work with more larger community groups too. So we do a lot of different services.
So as it relates to schools in particular, what populations or age groups does CARE serve within the school setting?
We serve all age groups in the school setting. So we do have programs that work with kids before they get to school, 0 to 5. And then when they are in school, as the program you're probably most familiar with, is our Student Assistance Center, where we do one-time substance use specialized assessments for schools that have contracted with us, and then we're able to make referrals. And we do this in partnership with the counselors at the schools to really make sure we're wrapping around kids and all the systems that they're touching. We also do some other programs on site. We have groups. We have a lot of coalition work that we're part of. And then I always like to say it's important to support the parents, too. So we have a lot of parenting supports, parenting classes that really go back to helping the kids in their homes do very well, too.
So just for context and for our School Talks listeners, in my time as superintendent, we would deal with students who may have a substance abuse issue or they're caught with something in school, and CARE always provided us an opportunity to create an incentive for the student to get some help in order to return to school. In many, many cases, we made, at minimum, an appointment with CARE, some type of assessment and or referral, one of the primary conditions of their ability to return to school. And I can tell you, your staff there does a great job of helping families navigate a process that for many of them is completely foreign. Right? Where do I go? Who do I call? And so on. And I can tell you, as I said, in my time as superintendent, we have used CARE in a number of ways in that capacity. So within that assessment lens, what is the process? Help our School Talks listeners understand, what's the process for actually obtaining an assessment through CARE?
So it starts with what you had mentioned, is that the school district contracts with us for this service. And we try to make sure that all the parents get that information or the school personnel have that information to be able to identify when to make that referral. A parent can call us directly without the school intervening under that contract, or the school can make the referral to us for that. And it's been very interesting. I mean, we have a long history working with you, which has been great. And over the years, we'll see different reasons that kids come in. So vaping has become much more prevalent. And so now we're seeing a lot of referrals around kids that are vaping. And what we like to do with this assessment is sometimes it's just really seeing how pervasive of a problem is going on. How much is it impacting the kid? Is there just some education that needs to happen, or is there something deeper that we really need to do an intervention with? But also what I like to really point out is sometimes our intervention is just giving the parent permission on how to intervene with the kid. I think lots of times as kids start to age, parents go through this place where they're not sure, how much do I look through their phone or go into their room, or how much do I really, should I ground them or monitor what they're doing? And as we know, we like to prolong kids experimenting with substances, because the earlier that they start to experiment, the more likely we are through adulthood to have an addiction develop. So a lot of our work is helping the parents know, how do I intervene, and also assessing the child for how deep has this gone, what is going on with them.
Tell us more about, I believe this is your 30th year, the parenting conference coming up on March 1st. Tell us about that.
Oh, the parenting conference is probably my favorite event that CARE does. It is so wonderful. So the first Saturday of every March, we do a parenting conference. It is for professionals, for parents, and caregivers. So a lot of people that run in-home daycares also come to our conference. And every year we hold it at the MISD on Garfield, and they are a great partner with us. And we have a keynote speaker that comes in with a message. Usually this is a nationally renowned speaker. And we have breakout sessions as well. And we really touch upon different things, how to manage your child in social media, vaping that we did talk about, a lot of focus on how to co-parent. Maybe if you have divorced parents, how do you co-parent? These type of subjects are what we really like to bring in, and hope that people take something from that day that really makes a difference. It is very positive. We get tremendous positive reviews for it. There is a fee, but we have scholarships available from all of our wonderful sponsors in the community that really rally behind us, which would be Macomb Community Mental Health, First State Bank. When they sponsor us, we use those dollars to provide scholarships to families that maybe wouldn't necessarily be able to afford the registration fee. But it is a tremendous conference. I encourage anybody to call, look into it. We really want to get our attendance as high as we're allowed to there.
And, you know, there's no better part of your title than CARE, given how much care and support you provide to the community. And we're out of time for now. Susan Stieff, I want to thank you, the CEO of CARE of Southeastern Michigan. Please continue to keep up the great work, because it's stuff like this that really makes a difference. And I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me on. And it's really good to talk to you again since you've retired.
That will do it for the program today. I'd like to thank our guests, mental health professionals Nikki O'Donnell and Jess Forshee, and from Fraser Public Schools, Carrie Wozniak, and from CARE of Southeastern Michigan, Susan Stieff. I'd also like to wish all of our School Talks listeners a very happy and safe holiday season. All the best to you and your families. And above all, remember, there are two ways to spell one and three ways to spell two. Until next time, this has been School Talks on 760 WJR.